Boker Tov, everybody. On behalf of Torah Motion and 929, that's a pleasure to welcome you all to the first of 24 shiurim on Tanakh. And it's a pleasure of David Silber, the founder of Drisha, such a creative thinker, an original thinker, and always a pleasure. We've had the pleasure of having him in our home a number of times. It's a pleasure to have him kick off the series. Today's shiur is being sponsored by Morris and Doreen Sosnowitz, in observance of the Yortzeit of Morris's father, Avraham ben Yehuda Noach, the Neshama should have an Aliyah. We should celebrate happy occasions, machod, and have long life. Okay, Rabbi Silber, it's all yours. Vakasha.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you virtually, all of you. Many years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I was walking on the west side of Manhattan, and a woman called out to me. She had been a student of mine right at the beginning of Drisha, maybe in 1979, 1980. And she called me over and she said, "I have a question for you. Many years ago, you said all paths lead to Genesis. Is that still true? Still believe that?" I said, "That more than ever. Everything takes us back to the foundational text, which is Breshit. All paths lead to Genesis." So looking at Breshit, we're looking not just, as Jay said before, not just at Breshit, but the introduction to the entire corpus, to Torah Shebichtav, which itself is the foundation for our traditions as well, Torah Shebaal Peh. So what is the book of Genesis about? What is this book about? And those questions are not so easy. It's a lot easier to answer what is the 23rd verse in chapter 12 about, that's easier. But what is the book about? And it strikes me that the book of Breshit, what it's about essentially is a blessing, which is a passed down from generation to generation. It begins with Abraham, who's given the blessing in chapter 15 of Breshit. And this blessing is passed down to his son, to one of his sons, and that son has to pass the blessing down to another son, and then that blessing is then passed down to all of the sons. I say sons, it is a patriarchal book. It talks in terms of fathers and sons, although the way the blessing is passed down, those who understand the blessing and enable it to be passed down, certainly for the first two generations are women. Sarah, in the first generation, understands who the correct heir to the covenantal blessing is. I speak of the covenantal blessing. Rivka, of course, understands very well which of her twins is the covenantal twin. And it's passed down from generation to generation. And then when you get to the next generation, it, as I said, it's passed down to the entire, all sons, which means that every member of the family, as the Torah sees it, is included in the blessing. So there's a process of selection that takes place. Avram is selected. He has two brothers. God selects Avram to go, Lech Lecha. And then the issue with Avram is which son shall succeed him. That's one of the core issues in the narrative. Turns out to be Yitzchak and not his brother Yishmael, who does have a blessing, but not the covenantal blessing. And then Yitzchak has twins. He seems to be inclined to give the covenantal blessing to Esav. And that would be a mistake. Rivka sees it differently, and she maneuvers it in such a way that the blessing goes to Yaakov. And then Yaakov's mission is to pass the blessing down to all his sons, which he does at the end of Breshit, where he calls all his sons together, and he blesses them all. So I would say that, what is the book about? The book is about a patriarchal blessing, or a blessing given to the people, particular people, and the passing down of the blessing, and the difficulty, actually, in passing the blessing down selectively to one child and then to all the children. However, the book of Breshit does not begin in chapter 12 or the end of chapter 11, when God says to Avram, as he's called there, Lech Lecha. It begins rather in chapter 1, verse 1.
Rabbi, can I just interrupt for half a second? If you mind adjusting your camera a little bit, we don't see your whole face. That's better.
Okay, fine.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt, okay.
No, thank you. So the book begins actually with chapter 1, verse 1, which is the first of the creation stories. That's chapter one, one creation story. Then the Torah gives us a second, different creation story, chapters two and three. And the focus there is on the, not the creation of heaven and earth, but rather these are the Toldot Shamayim Va'aretz. And the Toldot Shamayim Va'aretz, in the second creation narrative, speaks of a specific place that the Torah calls the Garden, Gan Eden, and the ensuing banishment from the Garden of Eden. So there are two things happen in the first two creation narratives. There is the creation of a world in chapter one, and then that world is destroyed in chapter six. That's the story of the flood, story of Noah. That world is destroyed. The waters which separated in the beginning of the Torah are conjoined together. The world is destroyed and then reborn. And then that's one creation story. And the second creation narrative, which is about sacred space, a particular space where God and the human being can dwell together, that's the banishment from the Garden of Eden. And it's a banishment from Eden to which we shall never return. In the Torah, you don't go back to the Garden of Eden. You can't get back there. The path is blocked with the flaming sword, Cherev HaMetapechet, with the Kruvim that guard the entrance. So there, it's not going back to Eden, but rather it's discovering a kind of alternative Eden. That's the alternative Eden. So the way the Torah works is that the first creation narrative is redone through the person of Noah. Noah is described as in the generation of Noah, when Noah is instructed that Noah is to govern the world, to help God govern the world. And the Torah says, Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam damoyi shofech ki b'tzelem Elohim asat ha'adam. The Torah says that from now on, the human being is responsible for the world in a very different way than previously. In the beginning, God responsible for God's world. The world is good. Human mistakes stain the world. God blesses, God curses. But when Noah emerges from the ark, Noah blesses and Noah curses. And Noah is given the responsibility to govern. And in particular, murder is singled out as a crime. Ki b'tzelem Elohim asah et Adam. The human has been created in God's image, in God's tzelem, which is exactly the description of the Torah of the creation of the human in chapter one. Vayivra Elohim et Adam b'tzalmo. So what Noah does essentially is he is the new order. He is the recreating of a world. The first world has perished in the flood, but there's a new world. The commands to Noah are essentially parallel to the commands in chapter one. Pru, revu, mu, ta'aretz. The difference is that the relationship to the world has changed after the flood. Noah is more of a governor of the world. Noah is a responsible for the world. Noah has more privileges and rights in the world. He's not a vegetarian. He's permitted to eat meat. So Noah is a redoing, and the character of Noah is a redoing of the first creation narrative. But the second creation narrative, that is to say, the discovery of the sacred space, that's not Noah. Noah doesn't discover the sacred space. The one who is actually called to discover sacred space is actually Abraham. And in two different ways. One is that the alternative sacred space, and here the word alternative is critical. You can never go back to the Garden of Eden, but you can go to a different space that God will occupy. And if you behave properly, you can share that space. And actually there are two spaces in the Abraham narrative. The first is the first Lechucha, chapter 12, El Aretz Asher Areka, the place that I will show you, which turns out to be in chapter 12, verse number 7, Vayera Elohim al Avram, Vayomer lezaracha tein et haaretz hazot. When Avram comes to Shechem, to the land of Canaan, then God does appear. And that's the first alternative sacred space. The first alternative sacred space is the land of Canaan, the land where God is present, the land where God speaks. That's the first alternative sacred space. And then there's a second lechucha, a second directive to go to the place. Again, Lechucha, the term Lechucha appears only twice in the Bible, by the way. The whole Bible, it appears two times. Chapter 12 and chapter 22. In 22, it's the Akedah. There is once again to the place that Asher Omari Lecha. The parallels between 12 and 22 are very striking. In any event, the holy space within the sacred space, call it the temple, call it Har Moriah, call it the Mishkan. So these are the alternatives to Eden. They're not Eden. They are the alternatives to Eden. And Avraham is the one who will uncover or discover, who is directed towards the sacred space, the alternative to the Garden of Eden. The one who understood this last point, that essentially the land of Canaan, and I mean, I spell it out much more, but the one who understood this very well, it's one of the central theses of his commentary on the Torah, his great commentary is the Ramban, actually. This found in the Ramban in several places, who sees the land of Canaan, the land of Israel, the temple, as kind of alternatives to Eden. That's an interesting study in its own right. But come back to the first point of this short presentation. The patriarchal narrative, if you wish to call it that, the blessing, may be the central theme of Genesis, but it is very interesting to note that the patriarchal narrative has been embedded in the creation narratives. And by the way, when I say creation narratives, I refer not just to chapter one, the first creation description in chapter one, the second creation description in chapters two and three, but in the spirit of what I just suggested, the creation narratives continue. In other words, the Noah story is a creation story. It's a recreation story. And not only that, the story of Avraham is also a creation story. It's a recreation, it's a reformulation of sorts of the story of God's creation of a world, yes, but within that world there is a sacred space in which the human and God can share and can communicate. And Avraham is the one who both in the first command of Lech Lecha, in God's first speech to Avraham, and in God's final speech to Avraham in 22 with the Akedah, he's the one who will discover this sacred space. So one might say, in a sense, that Avraham completes the creation narratives. Now, when I say Avraham completes the creation narratives, it all sounds so simple, you know what I mean? And actually, it's very simple. The truth is, the deepest and profoundest truths usually are quite simple. And I would take credit for this, I do, but somebody understood this way before me, whoever this person may be, whoever it was that composed the central prayer of Rosh Hashanah, called Zichronot, understood very well how the creation story proceeds in the book of Bereshit. Because the Zichronot, if you remember them, and we're not so far from Rosh Hashanah, the Zichronot have three pieces to them. It begins, Atah Zocher Maaseh Olam, begins with God remembering your creation and remembering in the Rosh Hashanah service in the beginning of Zichronot, which is the central prayer of Rosh Hashanah. It's right in the middle. That's about judgment. It's about God judging nations, Alam Dinot, God judging individuals in all kinds of different ways. Zayom Tchilat Maasecha, and this day we say on Rosh Hashanah is the first day, a remembrance of the first day, but that the text means the day the human was created. Zikaron Liyom Rishon. It's remembrance of the first day, which midrashically is the day that Adam both sins and is judged. So when the midrashim and the Rosh Hashanah text plays off the midrash, that the day Adam was created, that Friday, and Eve as well, they sinned. On the day they sinned, they were judged. And the day of Rosh Hashanah in our tradition is the sixth day of creation, which reminds us of a day, it's a day of judgment. It was a day of judgment from the first Friday, from that sixth day. And we enter into judgment willingly and accept the judgment. That's how we begin the Zichronot of Rosh Hashanah. And then suddenly, and it's a judgment from which no human can escape because God knows everything. What we do, what we think, what our true motives are. Maaseh Adam, Tachbul Otav, Yitzrei Mal Le'ish. How could one escape such judgment? Well, one can't. But the text then continues on Rosh Hashanah. Suddenly a new person enters into the service of Rosh Hashanah, surprisingly. Starts with Adam, then you move to Noah. And with Noah, it's different. With Noah, it's true that God judges fairly. However, Ashri isha lo yishkachekel. Happy is the one who doesn't forget God. Ki dorshecha lo yikashego. Those who seek God out. Drisha. Those who seek God out will not stumble. And then it continues, v'atah doresh ma'aseh kulam. And you seek them out. In other words, God is a judge, but God also is a seeker. God is doresh. Those who seek God are sought by God. So there's some hope. And then you move to theme number three, and the main theme of Zichronot of Rosh Hashanah, that's how it ends, Zocher HaBrit, and the main character in Rosh Hashanah is Abraham. It's the Avot in general, it's Abraham in particular, and if you remember the Rosh Hashanah service, how it ends, how that blessing ends, it ends with Akedas Yitzchak. So the author of the Zichronot understood very well, as it says in Pirkei Avot, 10 generations from Adam to Noah, 10 generations from Noah to Abraham. We think of Abraham as the beginning, which he is. His name is Avram, exalted father. He's the beginning, he's the first, he's the father. But he's also the last. 10 generations from Adam to Noah, 10 generations from Noah to Abraham, which the composer of the Rosh Hashanah service understands that they each represent a certain quality. Adam represents judgment, strict judgment. Noah represents God's mercies in the context of judgment. Abraham represents covenant. Now, since this is not a shiur about the davening of Rosh Hashanah, I'm not going to get into the specifics of that. Extraordinarily interesting. But my point is that the service of Rosh Hashanah, the Zichronot, which is the main service of Rosh Hashanah, the day is called, after all, Yom HaZikaron in our liturgy, is modeled upon and understands very well that Abraham is not just the beginning. He's also the end. Now, I'll come back to that in a minute, what I mean by the end. But I'll tell you a little story. I've mentioned this many times. Many years ago, I had a deep interest and still have some interest in classical music. And I had a friend of mine, a very young musician. And he sent me a gift. Many years ago, we had records in those days, vinyl. He sent me a good recording of the 24th piano concerto of Mozart. Mozart has two piano concerti in minor key. It's D minor. It's one of the great compositions of Mozart. So they used to come with they come inside a jacket, you know, and you read the cover, you read the back of it. And I'm reading this thing. I listened to a lot of, but my mother taught me that Mozart, he comes before Beethoven. That's my new Mozart. He's the guy before Beethoven. Anyway, so I'm looking at this jacket cover and it talks about Bach. It's all about Bach. Mozart was so innovative. Mozart took the Baroque, Mozart innovations. So I put the record on, I listened to it, and you know what? I'm hearing Bach, not just Beethoven. And my point is, it's all there. When you read Abraham, you read the beginning. Abraham, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, it's all true. But in reading the Abraham narrative of Genesis, you have to be sensitive to the creation narratives. The Abraham narrative is part and parcel, maybe the conclusion of the creation stories. And that's what the composer of the Rosh Hashanah service understood. 10 generations from Adam to Noah and Noah to Abraham, he completes creation. He discovers the alternative sacred space. Alternative because you can never go back to Gan Eden. And the reason you can't go back to Gan Eden in the Chumash, and my wife has suggested this to Rosh Hashanah many times, once you have knowledge, you can't go back. The Garden of Eden is not a place for beings that have complete knowledge and can be held responsible for everything we do because we should know better. So once you have knowledge, you can't go back to the place of non-knowledge when knowledge is off limits. So you have to live in a different place, but you can discover, uncover, or build perhaps an alternative Eden. Now, when I say that the book of Bereishit is the patriarchal narrative embedded in the creation narratives, I want to make one further point about this, which is very important about understanding Bereishit. And that is that the Akedah, which is chapter 22, is all about Abraham's discovery of the sacred place. The term the Torah uses in chapter 22, by the way, interestingly enough, is the word hamakom, the place, hamakom. Use it four times. The place, not a place. El hamakom asher amar elecha, to the place. What's interesting is, there's one other place in the book of Bereishit where the Torah uses the word hamakom as a central word. And I believe it appears there six times for a total of 10. In fact, these two stories have to be read together. And the other story where you have hamakom is not in chapter 22, but rather in chapter 28. It's when Yaakov actually is leaving the land. Yaakov is forced to run away, having taken his brother's blessing. Esav is angry. Esav threatens to kill him. Yaakov has to run away. Yaakov has to run away for a second reason, which is to find a wife, the appropriate wife. Esav has married Canaanite women, which disqualifies him from the covenantal blessing. Yaakov must find the appropriate wife, run to his mother's household. So the two reasons why Yaakov leaves. And when Yaakov is leaving, he has a dream. He goes to sleep, and behold, he sees angels of God ascending and descending. Above the ladder or the staircase is God, who speaks to Yaakov and says, I am with you, etc. I'm with you. I'm going to guard you. I'll protect you. Yaakov says, when Yaakov wakes up, he's very frightened. The place is awesome. Certainly this is the house of God. He means above me is the house of God. And Yaakov takes a vow, a neder, if you care for me, protect me, bring me back, I will build the house of God here on earth, which is opposite of the house of God above. To use the rabbinic terminology, Yerushalayim shel mala, Yerushalayim shel mata. So Jacob has discovered when he goes to sleep, he goes to sleep in that place for the sun has set, unaware of where he is initially. Lo yodati, he says. He discovers the sacred space in the beginning of his career, unbeknownst to himself. The place from which God speaks, Hamakom, the place. Abraham discovers the place at the end of his career. The Akedah for Abraham is the culmination of his life. Some other time, maybe I spend an hour or two about the Akedah. But it's the culminating moment of Abraham's life. It's God's last speech to Abraham. So Abraham understands everything perfectly. That takes place at the end of a life with all kinds of problems. Figuring out the relationship to his child, his covenantal child, to his wife, whom he calls his sister on two occasions. He figures it all out at the Akedah. That's the culminating moment. But Jacob encounters Hamakom in the beginning of his career. So what does that say to us in terms of the book of Bereshit? What it says, I believe, is this, that when it comes to Abraham, his mission, and the difficult mission it is to discover the sacred space. That's Abraham's mission. But Jacob has a different mission. Jacob's mission in life is not to discover the sacred space. Jacob's mission in life is to return to the sacred space. But which of these two is more difficult is a very good question. Jacob leaves to the house of Lavan. Torah says in chapter 29, Vayisoy Yaakov Raglav, Vayelach Arza B'nei Kedem. He goes to the land of the east, of Kedem. Kedem in the book of Genesis, up to that point, is the place that if you go there, you never return. East of Eden, you don't go back to Eden. Kedma, Lot went mi Kedem, Lot goes east. Migdal Babel is mi Kedem, in the east, not from the east. You never return. To Jacob goes Arza b'nei Kedem, and the reader is wondering, can he come back? God has promised to protect him, to care for him. His mother had said, you go a few days. God says it's not going to be a few days and it's dangerous. No one has ever come back, but Jacob will return from Arza b'nei Kedem. That's Jacob's mission, to go back to the place. And that's Jacob's mission writ large at the very end of the book of Genesis, which Jacob instructs Joseph, take me back to the land of Canaan, not in Mitzrayim. And says to Joseph, in the same way I return from the exile, from the place where God does not speak, you, Joseph, are entrusted with the responsibility to make sure that you too and your descendants and your brothers and the family are able to return, to go back to the place, to return to the place. That's Jacob's mission. So the creation stories actually extend even beyond the Akedah, even beyond the Akedah. They extend to, of course, at the Akedah, Abraham is discovering the place. But then the question the Torah puts out there in the book of Bereshit is, what about if you leave? Can you return? Is it possible to come back? And that's Jacob's mission. Jacob, after all, Israel, is the main character, together with Abraham, of the book of Bereshit. There are other significant characters as well, but that's Jacob's mission. Before I get to say something about the patriarchal narratives and how they play out in Genesis, let me just give an example of how embedding the patriarchal narrative in the creation narrative is important towards an understanding of Sefer Bereshit. And I'll give you one simple example. There are actually several very interesting examples of this. I'll mention one. One of the typologies that we find in the book of Bereshit, we have three stories in Genesis about a man who says that his wife is in fact his sister. Abraham says it in chapter 12, prior to going down to Egypt. Abraham says it in chapter 20, when he goes to the land of the Philistines, to Gerar. And Isaac, in chapter 26, who finds himself in Gerar, also says, when inquired, when they ask him, that Rebekah is, in fact, his sister. So there are three sister stories. When you have three parallel stories like this, obviously the Torah's intention is to enable us to compare and contrast the three stories, which we're not going to do now. But there are three sister stories. Going back to the first story, Avram, who is instructed to go to the place that I will show you, which is the land of Canaan, God appeared to Avram, Vayera, Vayiven Sham Mizbech Hashem Hanir'eh Elav, so God appeared. And the commentaries were troubled, to put it mildly, about this behavior. What do we make of the fact that Avram, there is a famine, and a difficult famine, but he leaves the land to which he was directed to go, and he goes to Egypt. He says his wife is his sister. She gets taken by Pharaoh. God has to intervene with plagues. What do we make of this behavior? So the medievals, and I would say typically, there is, an impulse that many of our, in our tradition, and our great teachers have, to try to defend the behavior of our heroes. In one form or another. The Ramban actually on the spot does not make that attempt. He faults Avram on two counts. First of all, he should never have left in the first place, says the Ramban. And on top of that, he endangered his wife. He's put his wife in a terrible situation. He didn't intend to, but that's what happened in effect. That was a mistake, says the Ramban. Chata is a sin. That's the Ramban. Others have tried to put a better face on it. Amongst them is the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, who in his Drashot dedicates a chapter trying to explain what was Avram thinking. And he tries to explain it. I'm not going to get into the details of that now. Very interesting. Now the question is, when you look at the Chumash, what evidence is there in the Chumash as to how the Torah sees that story of Avram saying that my wife is actually my sister? So what's interesting is, if you start studying the Torah from chapter 12, which is a bad idea, but if you did that, you would start with the Abraham narrative. The Torah begins with our founding father. But when you read the Abraham narrative in conjunction with the creation stories, with the first 11 plus chapters, then it's very interesting. There are two parallels that are striking within that story. In the story of the Garden of Eden, when the snake approaches the woman and the snake says, I heard you can't eat any of the fruit. Oh, that's not true. We can have all the fruit. That tree in the middle of the garden we can't take. Betochagan, lest we die. Not going to happen, says the Nachash. And the Torah says, Vatera Aisha, the woman saw. Ki tova etzlu ma'achal v'tava l'aynayim nechmar l'askir. The woman saw it was good. She saw it was good. Vatikach mi piyo, and she took and she ate and she gave to her husband as well, to her man as well. So there the Torah describes this primal sin as seeing what is good and taking, as chapter 3. Then when you move forward in chapter 6 says, it says the human being was flourishing, was growing, daughters were born to them. Vayiru b'nei Elohim et b'nota Adam ki tov oteina. But the b'nei Elohim, literally the sons of God, whatever that means, saw, they see, that the daughters of the human, tovot, are good. They see it's good. Vayichu lahem nashim mikol asher bacharu. They took whatever they wanted. So again, we have exactly the same language, seeing and taking. In each case, what they see is good. In the first instance, it's the woman and the husband who violate the command given to them. Actually, the command was given to the husband, not to her, but she knows of it. She sees, it's good, she takes, violating God's command. In the second instance, there is no command, but you don't need a command at that point. The B'nai Elohim don't need a command, both because they are B'nai Elohim, and even if they weren't B'nai Elohim, whatever that means, we have already partaken of the tree of knowledge. We should know better. So those are two parallel stories with parallel consequences. In the first case, death. In the second instance, limitation on life, 120 years. Two parallels. Now we come to Abraham in chapter 12. Abraham said to Sarah, say you are my sister. Why? Uman yitavli bavurech, that it will be good for me. V'choyton nafshi b'golech. Next verse. And it came to pass when they came down to Egypt, vayiru ha-mitzrim et ha-isha, the Egyptians saw her. They praised it to Pharaoh. Vatukach ha-isha, and she was taken, seeing and taking. Next verse, Uli Avram heitiv bavura, and for Abraham it was good, and they gave him many gifts. So notice something very interesting. In the first two stories, the seeing and taking, and the one who sees and takes sees that it is good. But in story number three, you have the seeing and the taking, but it's preceded and followed by the word tov, but the tov doesn't relate to the Egyptians. The tov relates to Abraham. In other words, what Abraham essentially has done is, whatever his motive, he has benefited from the fact that tov accrues to him, which makes him, in a sense, a partner. He has aided and abetted and benefited. So clearly, the Torah sees Abraham's behavior as highly problematic, was not his intention. But at the end of the day, this story, which takes place in the beginning of the Abraham narrative, sets the stage for the relationship of Abraham and Sarah, and a rocky one it is. And that's one of the core issues that has to be worked out, this relationship, because in point of fact, Sarah, says God, is not your sister. Sarah, says God, is your wife, and not just wife, your covenantal partner. And that's one of the core issues in the Abraham narrative. That's the difficulty of passing on the covenantal blessing is, to pass on the covenantal blessing, you have to understand how it works. Who was the covenantal recipient? But my point is just a small example of how reading the patriarchal narrative in the context of the creation narrative suddenly casts a light upon the very text we are reading in chapter 12. Chapter 12 then can be understood, or one of the intertexts of chapter 12. There can be a range of intertexts. That's another conversation. But one of them certainly are the creation stories that preceded the seeing and the taking and the good. So story number three is a variation upon the first two. Okay, let me get back to two other points now in this overview of Bereshit. And when you give an overview, of course, this in no way means that we shouldn't look specifically at every verse and every letter and study it very carefully. Book of Bereshit is a foundational book. It's also awesome book, but I mean, it has to be studied very carefully, but it's good to get the big picture, because very often we get so stuck in the details that we forget that there actually is a book here and there's a story here. It has a beginning, it has an end. The book of Genesis is part of the Torah, the five books. The book of Shemot is a continuation of Genesis, actually, V'eilu Shemot. On the other hand, it is a discrete book in our tradition. Each book is discrete, has a beginning and has an end. Now, in terms of the difficulty of transmitting the blessing from generation to generation, so in the first instance, it's Abraham finally recognizing at the Akedah that Isaac is a covenantal son. He loves Ishmael, no question about it, but he's not covenantal. Isaac, the son of Sarah, the son of Abraham, is the covenantal son. And that blessing is transferred. One might say that the transfer story of chapter 22 is when the blessing to Yitzchak is confirmed. God confirms it. It's confirmed through an oath, Binishbati Num Hashem, that Isaac is the one who is covenantal. So Isaac has the blessing. And then we have a second transfer story in the Torah, the transfer story of chapter 27. Isaac then has to transfer the blessing, covenantal blessing, in chapter 27 to one of his sons. He has twin sons. And the question, of course, in the Torah is which of these twin sons shall receive the blessing? From the Torah's perspective, it's one of the two. It can't be both, not at this stage. That it can't be both, by the way, that it's got to be passed down to one. There's a selection process. Abraham was the first selected one. Isaac is the second selected one. And one of Isaac's sons will be the third selected one. And then in the fourth generation, the blessing then can be distributed to more than one, to the group. The blessing can be shared. That's how the book of Genesis describes the blessing. And in truth, it's actually very interesting to take a note of the fact that when the covenantal blessing is spoken to Avraham, that's chapter 15, Brit Ben Habatarim, there the Torah distinguishes between three generations and the fourth. The three generations are represented by the animals that are cut in half. It's interesting. They're split in half. They represent the generations of suffering. The fourth generation is represented by the birds that are not cut. So on one level, it means that the three generations suffer, the threefold suffering, the conditions of the covenant of Genesis, Geirut, Avdut, and Inui. When Abraham said, with what shall I know I shall possess the land? In chapter 15, his primary question is not, I find it hard to believe. One can read it that way, but I don't believe that's what it means. Bama'eda doesn't mean, how can I know it's going to happen? Bama'eda means, through what will I know? What does it cost? What's the price? Covenants are two-sided. When someone tells you about unilateral covenant, disregard that. There's no such thing. There is no unilateral covenant. Unilateral in the sense it's not canceled by misdeed, that's possible. But unilateral in the sense that it's one-sided and doesn't require a two-sided commitment, that can't be by definition. That's what the Brit is. The Brit is two-sided commitment. What is our commitment to securing the sacred space, the purpose of all creation? What is the commitment? What does it cost? What is the price? And God says to Abraham, a threefold price. Ger yezaracha, be a stranger, an outsider, avadum, in slavery, inui, and being mistreated, tortured, mistreated, abused. And that's the three animals that are cut in half represent the three generations. Then God says, v'dar rivi'i yashuvu hena, but the fourth generation shall return, and the fourth generation represented by the birds. The birds are not cut. Means the covenant takes place over three generations and then four generations, three and four. Those that suffer do not possess. Those that possess do not suffer. And the covenant works when the two groups of people see the other as part of their own experience, as part of their existence. It's what the Passover Seder is all about. It's about that covenant and seeing ourselves as connected deeply to the other, to those who come before us and those that will come after us. So that's the covenant. Interesting is three and four. And three and four is how the covenant plays out in Genesis. The three generations of suffering are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the fourth generation that shall return to the land, that is presumably Jacob's sons. Return to the land possibly means possessing, symbolically possessing the land. And that story would be the story of Shechem. Now, there are other things to say about that. Can't get into that now, but the story of Shechem, which is Jacob's sons, Jacob's not involved. Jacob's sons is a symbolic possession of the land. So what, but we're up to when it comes to Isaac, as Isaac says, when Esau said, don't you have another blessing? And Isaac says, no, I have one blessing, one covenantal blessing. There's only one covenantal blessing. So we're still in the process of selection. So chapter 27, which is the process of selection, has to be understood in light of chapter 22. Chapter 22 is the transfer of the blessing from Abraham to Isaac. Chapter 27, from Isaac to one of his sons. I can't get into the details of chapter 27 right now. It's extraordinarily interesting. And I'll put a plug in for my wife's little book that she wrote many years ago. She was very young. It's called From Father to Son. It's an excellent book. And in that book, among other things, she has a discussion of the contrast between chapter 27 and 22, which is terrific. That would take an hour to explain now. But my point is, get a chance to look at that, it's worth it. My point is that we have in this instance a selection process. The difficulty in chapter 27 is that in order for the blessing to work, I'll say very briefly, the one giving the blessing has to understand the nature of the blessing that he's given. And it turns out that Isaac apparently doesn't fully comprehend it, because if he fully understood the covenantal blessing, how could he possibly bestow it upon somebody whom the Torah has just told us in the last two verses of chapter 26 has married Canaanite women, which is a complete non-starter. So whatever one thinks of Jacob, Jacob is an appropriate candidate for the blessing. The reader says he may be an appropriate candidate for the blessing, but his behavior to this point is problematic. That is true. He has to learn to be a more of a moral agent, but he's not disqualified. Esav is disqualified. So in order for the blessing to work, Jacob has to become the person deserving of the blessing. That will take a long time, but it happens. And Isaac has to come to an understanding of the very nature of the blessing that he's trying to bestow, which does happen as well. That's very interesting. How that plays out in the Chumash is fascinating, but that's not our topic. The specifics are not our topic. So that passes on. It's Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. They're covenantal. Yishmael has a blessing. Esav is very successful. And then I want to get to the last point of the overview of how the blessing passes down to all the sons, to the next generation. I did want to make a point, though, about the very blessing that we're talking about, which is at the heart of Genesis, the covenantal blessing, the blessing of the land, the Brit Ben HaBetarim, which passes down at the end of the day from Isaac to Jacob, Jacob being Israel. If we had to pick one main character of the book, it's got to be Israel. It's Yisrael, it's Yaakov. Jacob is Israel. And now here's a very important point about this blessing. You know, I remember teaching many over the years at Risha, and I have students who stay with me for, some of them stay 10, 15, 20 years, you know, others less. And sometimes you say the same thing. Yeah, I'm sure I repeat myself many times over these 40 years or so. And I was talking about the covenantal blessing. And someone said, one second. Gerut, Avdut, Inui, enslavement, stranger. What kind of blessing is this? And I said, now you ask that question. I've been talking about this for 40 years. It's true. When you look at Jacob's life, who's the hero? He's the one who has the blessing. He's the blessing. What is Jacob's life about? Let's see. He, as a young person, is forced to run away from home. His mother loves him, but he apparently never sees her again. He runs off, he falls in love with a woman, ends up marrying her sister, and then ensues from that all kinds of acrimony within the family. His beloved son is almost killed by the brothers. His daughter Dina is raped. His father, Wakapui, is a ganav who rips him off and mistreats him for many years. Jacob has to flee and run away. When he gets home, his brother's coming towards him with 400 men, and Jacob thinks he's going to be killed with everybody. He manages to pacify his brother. Then we have the story of Dina and the story of Joseph, the sale of Joseph, 17 years old, his beloved son, ends up in Egypt, doesn't see his son for many, many years. At the end of his life, he goes down to Mitzrayim, which he hates, and he dies in Egypt. Pharaoh asked him, how old are you? And Jacob said, not as old as you think. Ma'ad v'ra'im ayu yemei shnei chayai. My life is short and miserable. Bad. This is the covenantal hero of the book of Genesis. Meanwhile, his brother, we feel sorry for Esau. His brother owns a country. Let's start with that. I mean, Bezos, move aside. This guy owns a country. Actually owns a country. When he walks around, he has 400 men. 400 is a big number in Genesis. 400 years, 400 shekels by the field, 400 men. Wealth beyond imagining, power beyond imagining. Poor Esau. Jacob, on the other hand, a more miserable life we can't think of, and he's covenantal. But that's exactly the point of the book. The point of the book is, one might say, to live by faith, which means not that things are going to be okay, not yiyeh tov, an expression I actually can't stand, yiyeh tov. No, it's not going to be tov. Maybe it won't be tov. But that's the consequences for entering into the covenant. For doing the right thing, there's all kinds of consequences. Many of them are not so tov, but they're the right thing to do. So I do the right thing despite the consequences. And that's the story of Genesis. That's the covenant. And most people don't want that covenant. We think of Yishmael, we think of Esav as being, don't they want the covenant? No. Most people don't want the covenant. I remember that day in my classroom. I said, how many people who want that covenant? No one raised their hand. You know what I mean? Gerut avdut inui. That's what it's about. It's believing in the future. It's believing in setting something up despite the price that you have to pay. So that's the covenantal blessing we're talking about in Genesis. That's the gerut and the avdut and the inui. And now the question is, in the overview of the book, can this covenantal blessing be passed down? And the covenantal blessing is, yes, a fulfillment of God's will in creation. That's part of the embeddedness. It's the fulfillment of God's will in creation. Can it be passed down to all the brothers? All the brothers means, can two people share the covenantal blessing? Up to this point, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, not only can they not share the blessing, but if you think about the way the book of Bereishit presents the family, when it comes to Isaac and Yishmael, okay, they don't get along. Okay, Yishmael laughs when Yitzchak is born. But one doesn't get a sense of deep animosity between them. And later on, it seems like they seem to get along fairly well. Yitzchak is in Be'er Lachai Ro'i, which is a place connected with Hagar and Yishmael. There doesn't seem to be great animosity between the two of them. But when it comes to Jacob and Esav, Yaakov and Esav, Esav says, the days of after my father dies, V'yar God Yaakov Achi, I'll kill my brother. Esav is a hunter, Esav is a killer. Esav says, I'll wait till my father dies. Rebekah's afraid he may not wait till his father dies. Rebekah's afraid he may do it the next couple of days. He's so angry. So he potentially will kill his brother. He intends at one point, certainly, to kill his brother. And when Yaakov comes back from the house of Laban after 20 years, he doesn't know whether Esav plans to kill him or not. He suspects the worst. So the relationship of the brothers has gotten worse. When you come to the next generation, to Joseph, whom Yaakov favors, there is not a question of planning to kill your brother. There is the point about actually trying to kill your brother. Let's not forget that when the brothers take this dreamer and throw him into the pit, and they sit down to eat their food, Joseph, if left in the pit, will die. And there's absolutely no intimation when they first throw him into the pit that they intend to take him out of the pit. Reuven had said to them, they had planned to kill Joseph when he meets them. Chapter 37, Reuven says, don't kill, we shouldn't kill him, he's our brother. Reuven meant to save him. But Reuven says to the brothers, we can't kill him with our own hands. Let's cause his death, but not kill him. Reuven distinguishes between causing death and killing. True, his intention is to save Joseph, to bring him back to his father. That's what he really plans to do. But what he says to the brothers, and they seem to accept it, okay, we won't kill him with our own hands. Throw him in the pit, in the middle of a desert. We are buried in Bomayim, there's no water. So the point is, there, they actually attempt to kill their brother. Yes, it is true that Cain killed Hevel. Of course, that's true. I'm talking within the patriarchal narrative. Cain killing Hevel means very simply that brothers are natural enemies. the natural enemies because they vie for the same thing. They vie for the father's approval, the father's blessing. But within the patriarchal narrative, my point is, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and then the fourth generation, Joseph, is not just wanting to kill your brother. Maybe I'll attempt it. It's actually attempting it. It's actually he will die. When Yehuda sees the travels in the desert, the camels, traders traveling in the desert going down to Egypt, and says, why should we kill him? Let's sell him. What profit is there in killing him? And it's not clear whether they actually sell him or not. The plain reading of the text is that they didn't actually get around to selling him. The Midianites came, intervened, and took Joseph out of the pit and sold him. But in any event, the selling him is better than killing him. The point is, the two options in the story are you sell him into slavery, send him into exile to wherever he may end up, or he dies. So in short, things are getting worse. They're not getting better. The question is, how do you turn this around? And of course, the Torah has a very interesting solution to the problem. The beginnings of the solution, and what makes the book of Bereishit so awesome, actually, there are many things. It's just big. It's the foundation of everything. But great books have another element to them, which is surprise. I've done a lot of work in recent years on Shmuel, writing something on Shmuel now in Hebrew. And the book of Shmuel, the author of the book of Samuel, whoever that may be, is someone who constantly surprises you, breaks all the expectations, writes a book and a chapter with the Balat Ov, the medium of Endor. Ov in the Torah is one of the great examples of idolatry. There's Ov and there's Molech. And they have a chapter in Samuel where the Balat Ov is the hero. So they're always surprised. The great books surprise you constantly. And in Genesis, the question is, chapter 37, they try to kill Joseph. Joseph's now in Egypt. Is there any hope for to create a structure where people can, in fact, share a blessing? What the Torah called earlier, I mentioned the story earlier where Jacob is running away from home and he has a dream. He goes to Hamakom, to the place. But the critical word actually in that story is, critical word is actually the word Bayit, Beit El, Beit Elohim. Beit Elohim. Jacob's dream, Jacob's hope is to build the Bayit. And the word Bayit in the Bible in general has several meanings. It can be a physical house, it can be a palace, it can be a temple. It can be a dynasty, House of David. It can be a family. The Bayit is the all-inclusive structure. What Jacob said to God in chapter 28 is, if you give me the opportunity, O God of Abraham and Isaac, if you give me the opportunity, I will make you the God of Jacob. That is to say, my own special relationship. We dwell within traditions. So my God is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Rachel, and Leah, and Sarah, and Rivka. But what about our own relationship? What about each of us is different? That's what Jacob said. If you give me the opportunity, bring me back, you'll be for me a God. I'll build you the Bayit. That's Jacob's dream, to build the structure. And he succeeds at the end. But before he succeeds, he has somebody who's trying to block his way at every turn, who tries to prevent Jacob from building this inclusive structure. His profound enemy in the book of Genesis, the deepest enemy, the most dangerous enemy Jacob has, which of course is none other than Jacob himself. His own favoritism, his own favoring Joseph and demonstrating it no less, is what stands in the way the house is built. It's built in such a way that that enmity, that strife, jealousy is built into the structure. Can you overcome it? The great surprise in Genesis is yes. Where is the key? Where is the solution to our problem in Genesis? How do you build? Can you build a house? And I have only 6 minutes now. I'll make a very simple point about one of the truly great chapters of the Bible, which itself becomes a model for other stories. And that's chapter 38 of Genesis. Chapter 38 of Genesis, the story of Judah and Tamar. As such, it interrupts the Joseph narrative. Joseph is sold into slavery in 37. 39 begins with Joseph being in the house of Potiphar. If you chopped out 38, you would never miss it, which is why some of the Bible critics think that chapter 38 was simply thrown in there. After all, it interrupts the narrative. First of all, let me just say, I must say this, not to say bad things, but the level of stupidity sometimes is mind-boggling. As if, you know, sometimes you take classes in school, going to teach you how to write. You have an introduction, you have a body of this, you have a closing. No great writer writes that way. The book of Samuel jumps back and forth constantly with David and Shaul. It's constantly jumping back and forth. And there's a reason for the jumping back and forth. So the idea that there's some form that every writer must take, and if you deviate, obviously someone just threw it in, is utter nonsense. Let's start with that. Fact of the matter is, 38 is exactly where it should be, because chapter 38 is the key to solving a very deep problem. Is it possible to build the Bayit? In 38, in the story of Judah and Tamar, from a plot standpoint, I think, is perhaps the key chapter in the whole book. Because what 38 says is, it is possible to have a situation where two brothers can share a blessing. The two brothers who share a blessing in chapter 38 are Peretz and Zerah, the two sons that are born to Tamar, who dresses up as a prostitute to entrap Judah, who has failed to fulfill his commitments to her. His two sons have died, and he's supposed to, son number three, whose name is Shelah, which means deception, Lahashloth means to deceive, so he won't give deception to Tamar. He says, wait till he gets older. He has no intention of permitting her to marry his third son because he blames her for the death of his first two. The Torah tells us flat out it's not her fault. God killed them. They're no good. But Judah, as a concerned parent, protects son number three. But he protects son number three at the expense of son one and two because the Torah in chapter 38 speaks of levirate marriage. The two sons have died. That is true. But Yibum means the kin lines of the deceased can be extended. So in failing to extend the kin lines of son one and son two, he has done them a deep disservice. True, he favors son number three, but that is inappropriate from the Torah's standpoint. And he sends Tamar away, but he doesn't simply send her away. He says, wait around. So he ties it to his family, but accepts no responsibility for himself, no responsibility towards her. And after many years have passed and Judah's own wife dies, and he sets off sailing for the coast of Mardi Gras, Timna, to shear the sheep. So she dresses up, she covers her face, takes off her widow's weeds that she's been wearing all this time. And she stands at the crossroads and Judah is attracted to her, his own wife having recently died. He says, let me come to you. What will you pay me? I'll send you a goat. No, no, she said, it's a cash business. We don't take credit here. And besides, there's somebody else who's been promising to send me something for many years. He never delivers. Okay, what do you want? Your staff, your seal, your coat, literally your cords, your coat, symbols of leadership, symbols of kingship. He gives them to her, he sleeps with her, she becomes pregnant with twins, no less. And it's gotta be twins because she's lost two children. She's lost two husbands. And now the twins, each one will replace one of the two deceased husbands. So those twins are both needed. It can't be one or the other. But the problem is, will Judah acknowledge the fact that he is the father? And by the way, being the father means he's the one who should perform levirate marriage because he's the second closest relative. So like the book of Ruth, he's not the closest, he's the second closest. If he acknowledges it, he hears she's pregnant, he says, let her burn, take her out to burn. She was betrothed to son number three. She's a married woman of sorts. Hypocrisy has no bounds here. Take her out to be burnt. And as she's being let out, she sends him a message. The staff, the seal, the coat. Do you know to whom they belong? And this is the critical moment. He has two choices. He can acknowledge it and accept the shame and embarrassment. But then he gets back his symbols of kingship. He gets back the leadership. And then the two children, the two fetuses will be born. If he denies it, she will burn together with these two unborn children. And Judah has a tough decision to make. Tamar believes in him. Tzadka mimeni. She's more righteous than I. And when he says that, when he confesses, through confession, what does he do? He reclaims back that which he has given her. What does the Torah call that which he has given her? The Eravon, the security, the Arev, the guarantor. And then the two children are born. and they're both included. I don't have time to go into it in depth, but let me make a simple point that the idea of the arev, taking responsibility, and the idea of confession as necessary for leadership, which brings people together, is exactly the story that you have in the rest of Genesis, beginning in chapter 39. It's Judah who will say to his father, send Benjamin with me, Anochi Ervenu. It's Judah who will say to Joseph, he doesn't know it's Joseph, Manedaberu Manit Stadok. We can't clear ourselves. We are guilty. Sodkami Mani. So the great lesson of bringing people together, the great lesson of leadership, of building the bayit, it's only through confession. Through confession and through acceptance of responsibility, you can actually build the bayit. The lesson is taught to Judah by this woman named Tamar. Who is Tamar? We have no idea. She's presumably a Canaanite, but the Torah never calls her a Canaanite. She is a woman with no lineage. She's the ultimate outsider. The ultimate outsider who teaches us how the covenantal blessing shall proceed. And let me just conclude by saying that if we think about the banishment from Eden, because after all, the covenantal blessing is about the replacement for Eden, the alternative Eden. What got us thrown out of Eden in the first place is the primal sin. And the primal sin in the Torah is less about eating of the forbidden fruit. It is that. But the real primal sin is something else. It's when Adam and Eve are hiding amongst the trees, Petoch Eitz Hagan. And God said to Adam, where are you? Ayeka. I heard your voice and I'm hiding. I realized I was naked. Who told you you were naked? You didn't eat of that fruit, did you? And that was our opportunity. What Adam could have said is, I have no excuses. There's no excuse. I did the wrong thing. If Adam had said that, we'd all be sitting now in the Garden of Eden. Maybe studying virtually in the Garden of Eden, maybe not. I don't know. If the pandemic affects the Garden of Eden, I can't answer that question. But he didn't say that. He said something very different. It's not my fault. It's her fault. And frankly, God, it's your fault. The one you put by my side, her fault, your fault, not my fault. That's what got us banished from Eden. The return to Eden, there's just one way back. Sodkami Mani. That's the lesson we learned from Tamar. That's the Eravon. That's the taking responsibility. So what I've tried to do in these few minutes is to give some overview of Genesis. I hope if you weren't already interested in Genesis, that I spark some interest. There's nothing like it. It is great in its own, and it's absolutely prerequisite to understanding the continuation of the Torah and the Bible in general, apart from being a pillar of Western civilization. And yes, it's true, as I told my student 15 years ago, all paths lead to Genesis. So thank you. I'll take any questions now if you have any comments or questions.
Thank you very much, Rabbi, for a wonderful kickoff of the series. Tomorrow morning, Marty Lakshin, Rabbi Dr. Marty Lakshin, is going to be giving on Shmuel. We invite everybody back. This evening, Mark Shapiro will be speaking 8:30, his regular class. It's a different login. You should have had the registered. We can send that out later. But anyways, thank you very much, Rabbi Silver. I'll give you a couple questions. Okay, I'll go back to the beginning on Zichronot. I talked about the three part of Zichronot, but then it continues. So the link to Shmuel, I guess tomorrow. So what is the link in Zichronot, the segue from Bereishit to Shmuel, if you want to comment on that?
I'm not sure there is a link in Zichronot to from Bereishit. You have to remember that Rosh Hashanah, actually, as we say many times in our prayers, Hayom Harat Olam. The theme of Rosh Hashanah is actually creation. And my point is that, given the fact that the theme is creation, that the Zichronot are presenting us with a broader picture of what is creation. There is no doubt, as you say very correctly, that the story of the, I'll just pick up on what you said just briefly, the story of the Exodus, the story of the Exodus is linked to Bereishit in the deepest ways. And one of them is that the very terms, Geirut, Avdut, and Inui, which appear in Bereishit in terms of Yaakov, Yaakov says about himself in chapter 31, I was an Eved at Onyivi at Yegia Kapai. When he goes back home, Imulavan Garti, But the other place that you have Gerut, Abdut, and Inui in the narratives in the beginning of the book of Exodus. In chapter 1, you have Abdut and Inui. In chapter 2, you have Ger, Gershom. So the stories are linked together in the deepest way. There's no question about it. But I'm not suggesting that the Rosh Hashanah Zichronot service per se is necessarily pointing us in the direction of Exodus, because there, the theme there is much more about God as God as creator. But we have been presented with this rather astonishing description of creation, which starts with Adam and then moves down to Noah and then to Abraham, and for a different reason as well, because Noah and Abraham, for the author of Zichronot, are a way to sweeten the judgment. You start with judgment of Adam, and there's no way out. God knows everything, our desires, our hidden motives, etc. And the problem that Zichronot is putting on the table for us is, how do we escape such a judgment on Rosh Hashanah? It's the Yom HaDin. How do we escape this judgment? What are our mechanisms to somehow to leave Rosh Hashanah alive, basically? And the answer, I think, is twofold. First of all, that if we behave a certain way, God will judge us differently. That's Noah. And the second point is, and the critical point is, we see ourselves as part of a covenant. We see ourselves as Abraham's children, as Sarah's children. We see ourselves differently. Our relationship is different. It's not so much, spare me because my grandfather was a great guy. It's more, I see my own life in that context. It's a path I want to walk. It's also a relationship that exists over many, many years. And you don't treat a relationship of 20 years the same way you treat a relationship of 3 days or 5 days or 1 year. So we're in for the long haul. The idea of covenant is we're in this for the long haul. And we're going to suffer together. And we're going to make mistakes. People make mistakes. But we're in this thing for the long term. So I think that's what I would focus in on Rosh Hashanah, would be on the creation, our relationship to God, seen through this prism of creation. I mean, your point is very well taken, and there certainly are relationships between deep ones, between Shemot and Reshit, but I don't think that's what the Rosh Hashanah, the davening, is about. Anything else?
Yeah, so we know Hamakom Yenachem Etchem, and talking about Hamakom, and could that be a reference to Yerushalayim, the Beit HaMikdash, and V'shachanti B'tocham, HaKadosh Baruch Hu giving Nechama?
I don't know. The truth is, Hamakom appears in rabbinic texts. I don't think in the Torah you actually have. You have in Shemot, Hinei Makom Iti, that you do have with Moshe in the cleft of the rock. Maybe it could be that. Hamakom Yenachem Etchem means, I don't know, God, I always saw it more in terms of the God who is in every place, in every situation. God is all-encompassing. And we should be able to find solace even when we are suffering a loss, and have setbacks in life, but we should be able to see it from God's perspective. God has a much broader perspective than we do. So maybe the idea of solace in calling upon Hamakom, we're asking God to enable us to see the world, not just through our own eyes, but to see the world through our own eyes and perhaps through God's eyes as well. The one who emphasized that, by the way, seeing the world through our own eyes, but also seeing the world through God's eyes, was none other than Abraham Joshua Heschel. That's the way he sees prayer. And when I pray, I see it one way, but I'm asking God to allow me to see it from God's perspective, to see things differently. So maybe that's how we'll call.
Okay, Jimmy pointed out Abraham took Vayikach, he took the ram, a sort of, I don't know, you know, that's a positive, if you want to say, a tikkun. Okay, let's see. Somebody asking about creation before the first Naseh Adam. That's related at all. I'm not sure if you want to, or how the word Elohim plays in the Chumash Elohim, referring later on. I guess that's in chapter 5, you know, the B'nai Elohim. And
the truth is, look, the there are many different approaches to the study of Bible. There are, you know, different names of God were used and probably still are used in certain areas of academia to suggest that there are different documents, different texts, and stuff like that. That there may be, that the Torah may be calling upon different traditions or different texts that existed at that time, or actually responding to different traditions. That would not surprise me. That was Kasuto's argument, that the Torah actually is responding to different creation narratives. The Torah tells its story in the beginning of the Torah. Elsewhere in the Bible, there are references to different ways to see creation. I have no problem with that. But personally, this idea of, you know, say this is text P and this is text H and this is text D and this is text E and this is text J, as if somehow we have, with any definitive sense, that we could say these are separate texts. And then, even if that were true, if there's something just randomly put together, that's something I don't think is, it's not my way of reading. I don't see that that way. The idea that there are traditions the Torah is calling upon, and the Bible in general, that doesn't disturb me at all. But the idea that we can somehow, in some definitive sense, to say this is that and this is, as a way of resolving problems, and I would say the following, that personally, what I don't like about the documentary hypothesis, or that form of it, is that, this is just me, it's too easy. When you have a contradiction, oh, that's no problem. That's said by X, that's said by Y. Trei tanoi valiba de X, you know what I mean? That's one way to resolve problems. But another way to resolve problems is to say, let's look at it more carefully. And perhaps there's not a contradiction here. Perhaps each text is looking at it from a different perspective. And that's more or less the way I, without getting into questions of documentary hypothesis, it's more about trying to understand what is the point of the text. And I come back to this central, it's what motivates my thinking about Tanakh and my teaching. I always ask one question, which is, what is this particular text, whether it's the Torah, whether it's Shmuel, whether it's Tehillim, what are they trying to teach me? What is this book trying to say to me? What are they trying to teach me? I presume I enter into this whole world with the sense of a student trying to learn from different voices. What are they trying to say? And I think what's important and very important about what you're doing here, Jay, in terms of this overview, is that very often we get stuck with the particular verses. And we don't actually look at the bigger picture and ask ourselves the big question, which is needed, as well as the small questions, which are important. What is this book about? What is it actually trying to say to us? I made one suggestion. The book is about how do you build a covenantal society? What are the elements required to building a covenantal society? What's the price you're willing to pay? And what is central to being able to stay in God's presence? And I would argue that in the book of Bereishit, it's taking responsibility for community, and it's about recognizing one's mistakes and limitations. And especially the leader, especially the king, especially Judah. And Judah is the one who's given the blessing of kingship. It's not Joseph. Because the truth of the matter is that until the very end of Sefer Bereishit, Joseph never really says, I made a mistake. Joseph never recognizes his own limitations till the very end, where he says, yes, God should save us all. I'm a slave. Take me back with you. I'm part of you. But till that point, Joseph is very brilliant, but Joseph doesn't say what Judah says, which is tzad kami meni. And a person who doesn't say tzad kami meni, actually, is a person who is very unlikely to bring people around him or around her and to be able to lead. It's the person who says, what do I know? I make a lot of mistakes, and I recognize my mistakes and our mistakes, and let's make it better. Such a person, I think, is someone, and that's necessary for leadership. And that's true of Judah, and that's true of David, as described in Shmuel. That's his strong suit. He's able to say, you know something, I made a mistake. And that's what's necessary to building a bayit, to building a community. It's recognizing our responsibilities, our limitations, and trying to fix what is wrong. I don't think anything I could say could be more timely than that in the world in which we presently live. That it's easy to blame the other guy, you know what I mean? And even if the other guy is guilty, it doesn't matter, actually, because the question is not where the virus came from. That's irrelevant at this point. The question is, what is our responsibility as members of the human society to do the right thing? That's the only question. You could blame China all you want. It doesn't make one way the difference because it's irrelevant. And that's the point of the Chumash. The point of the Chumash actually in Bereishit, the idea of confession, it's very interesting. There are many situations in Bereishit where someone says to somebody else, how could you do this to me? Sometimes the person who says this is not a very good person, like Avimelech. Or Lavan, how could you do this to me? Why did you lie? Why did you say he's my sister? Why did you run away? We don't like Lavan, but the fact of the matter is, Lavan's irrelevant. What the Chumash cares about is that Lavan. Chumash only cares about Yaakov, it cares about Avram, it cares about Yaakov, it cares about Adam. It cares about understanding what is our responsibility. So I think one of the key messages in this book, this foundational book, about building this bayit, Jacob's aspiration, but how do you build the bayit? And you build it through recognizing how it has to work. You can't favor one over the other. You try to find a place for everybody. Everybody has to have a place in this world. And we do our best to make places for all people, for their betterment and for everybody's betterment. So that's, I think, something which runs through Sefer Bereishit. And the one who finally confesses, and I'll end with this, is Judah. In the story when the goblet is found, the magical goblet is found in Benjamin's sack, and Joseph says, how could you steal this object? I was so good for you. How could you steal this thing? And the brothers know they didn't steal it. Benjamin didn't steal it. And the money in their own sacks, they didn't take that money. But Judah confesses, it's a deep confession. Because what he's really saying is, we didn't steal any goblets. But in point of fact, we require confession. We did something else wrong. The sale of Joseph, the cause of his sale, the mistreatment of our brother who cried to us from the pit. That's the cause of our problem. You may not know that, Viceroy of Egypt, but in point of fact, we are guilty. We confess to something else. And that confession actually, umanit tzadok, an acceptance of the responsibility, which was taught him by his Rebbe named Tamar, that's what sets everything right. That's what allows Joseph to release Benjamin, to confide in them, to reveal his identity, and to build the house. There's still tensions, there's still problems, they still don't trust him. But at the end of the day, we can live with the tensions, but we're moving in the right direction. So that's how the book of Genesis ends. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, really.
Yes, good work, Jay, as well.
Thank you, thank you. A number of people have asked, yes, these classes are recorded. Please go to go up before the end of the day so you can send on. Please invite your friends to register. We've got 23 more of these coming up. So this was just the kickoff, and hopefully Malin Bekodesh. And we look forward to hearing Dr. Lakshin tomorrow. I think his wife is still online. She wants to say hello. I can unmute people. And really, it's a pleasure seeing everybody. And I'm very proud of this. And Rabbi, really, it's a wonderful thing. And I want to thank Adam Mintz and Shira Hecht, you know, Kohler for helping me put together the whole program. Hi, Dr. Lakshin. I'm going to unmute people.
They didn't want people to congregate.
It's going
to
be a little bit dangerous. Hold on. I'm going to mute and unmute. You can unmute yourself. Everybody can unmute themselves now, so you're not automatically unmute. But anyways, thank you very much, everybody, and have a wonderful day. Be safe and be well, and yes, and continue up the wonderful learning that we've been going through this, the bright side, the silver lining of the pandemic, all the increased learning that Baruch Hashem.